Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Solari Report. Today it is my absolute pleasure to introduce to you someone who I've very long been a huge fan of, but we had not gotten him on, and I have been remiss in doing that. His name is John Titus. He did an incredible series bringing real disclosure to the financial situation during the bailouts, and then after a break, he's back. It'll never be safe for the central banks again. And he's just doing an amazing series. You can find him at Best Evidence in YouTube. And it's a pleasure to welcome him to the Solari Report. John Titus, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me, Catherine. It's a very great honor. I have been a longtime admirer of your work, much longer than you have admired mine, rest assured.
Well, I just went in again and watched your video, you know, Mommy, How Does Money Work? And when you unpacked the balance sheet and you had the numbers going up and down, I said, wow, that's incredible. I didn't even know you could do that.
Yeah. Well, when I got into video, I didn't have a camera. The light bulb went off in 2013 when I realized, hey, I don't need a camera to make a video. I can just do it with motion graphics. And that's what you're seeing is really my video. I'm self-taught doing this stuff. I don't know what I'm doing. But I watch a lot of YouTube videos, and that's motion graphics. So I got started with motion graphics. That's what you're seeing in that video.
Well, I think, you know, my impression of your work is you're a guy who thinks you can learn anything. I used to have a partner when we started Hamilton Securities, and our attitude was like, okay, nuclear waste. You know, how do we get the nuclear waste for dummies book? And
right.
But we really thought we could learn anything. And that's what I love about your work. You just dive right into the hard documents. So first, I really want people to get to know you. So if you could just take a minute, describe your background, how you became so irritated with what was going on in the financial crisis, and then take us up to your current mafiocracy.
Okay. I grew up middle class in Raleigh, North Carolina. I majored in electrical engineering. I got a master's in electrical engineering. I then got a law degree because it was obvious in the early 90s that manufacturing was going abroad. And after law school, I then joined a firm in Chicago that was a very small boutique firm. I was lawyer number 9. And that firm had just won. At that time, they had just prevailed in the longest litigation in the history of the United States federal courts, I think, which is a polypropylene litigation on behalf of Phillips Petroleum in a 5-way interference. And in fact, when I joined that firm in 1994, there was only one lawyer in the firm who was even alive when that litigation began in 1952. Everybody else was born out. So you know yourself from your own litigation history, litigation can take a life of its own. There's no reason that a litigation can last 100 years. This one lasted, you know, 40, 45 years, and these lawyers won. And when I joined this firm, I did not know that people like this existed. They were very smart. They worked. No, I'm serious. They worked.
Yeah.
They were smart, and they worked hard, and they told the truth. Their reasoning, they thought that if you had to lie, we worked against. Now, I did not work on that litigation, to be clear. They had a lot of other stuff going on, which is why I was brought in for the electrical stuff, not the petrochemical stuff. But their theory was if you had to lie, you were doing something wrong.
Right.
You weren't researching enough, you weren't spending enough time, you weren't working hard enough, or God forbid, you weren't smart enough, and you got shown the door. And so their theory, you know, they thought, like you were just saying, we can learn anything. And we can become better at it than the so-called experts. And they laid a huge emphasis on the clarity of writing and then the clarity of presentations. And that, my first 10 years of my career was spent at that little boutique. We later merged into a big global firm. But that's where I cut my teeth, and that has lasted a long time. Their whole thing was you need to prove your case brick by brick. It doesn't matter how long it takes, but no hand-waving.
Right.
No hand-waving. You got to get into the nuts and bolts no matter what it takes. And that's what they did. That's how they won.
So tell us about how the financial crisis really inspired you to go public with this.
I was asleep in front of the television until 2008. And when the bailouts happened on October 3rd, when TARP passed on October 3rd, 2008, I have never been angrier in my life. I'm not kidding. And it took me, I was so angry that I didn't even understand why I was so angry. I was just like so
well, I think
with
one
anger.
Of the reasons you were angry is you understood. Very few people really understood what was happening, what it meant. And you did. You had a deep comprehension of what it all meant.
I did, and I didn't. And ultimately, what I came to, it took me really 4 years to cope with my own anger. And ultimately, what I came to was the implications of the bailouts were that there was no rule of law.
Right.
And that was the big problem. And that was brought home to me in late 2012 when HSBC admitted to perpetrating all these crimes and nobody gets prosecuted. Nobody goes to jail. And just so your listeners know, it is legally impossible for a corporation to commit a crime without not only employees, but high-ranking employees committing crimes, not just garden variety crimes, but like systematic, right. huge crimes. Only right. then do you get to prosecute the corporation.
Right.
So that was when the rule of law went bye-bye because the DOJ, the Department of Justice, comes out and says, we can't prosecute HSBC because there is a doctrine in the U.S. Attorney's Manual called collateral consequences. And if we prosecute HSBC, it'll be Chicken Little. The sky will fall and the life as we know it will end. And that was a very dangerous precedent. It's one thing to say, the rule of law doesn't really exist because it's all done by people. It is quite another thing to come out and in principle say the principle is invalid because of collateral consequences. Then you have taken away people's argument to say, hold your feet to the fire and say, what about the rule of law? The rule of law is the trump card. They're now saying right. it's not the trump card. And that's right. where we are today. That is where all of this stuff with the pandemic is coming from.
Now, I have never seen a clearer presentation. I've never seen any clear presentation on the meaning of what the Department of Justice did. And you've really outed exactly what happened and how it happened and what this means. And to this day, I'm surprised that it hasn't been more clearly communicated to the general population what this is and what it means.
Right. It's a very dangerous thing. And I lay that out. I spent a year on a presentation or on a feature-length film, if you want to call it that, called The Veneer of Justice in the Kingdom of Crime, which right. I think I finished that in May of 2016, that lays out the history. It really picks up with that great PBS show Frontline where Martin Smith does a show called The Untouchables, and he does an incredible job with that. And The Veneer of Justice, which I did, picks up where he left off and says, hey, we need to talk about collateral consequences here. And that's really what that video right. is about. Then I spent another year doing a follow-up to that called All the Plenary's Men, where I explain, okay, since our rules don't govern, obviously, don't think that there's no rules that are determining outcomes. There are. Those rules are simply coming from the Bank for International Settlements. And I lay all that out.
Right. Now, you don't have those up on Best Evidence.
I do. They are.
Oh, they are.
They are.
Okay.
I've only got a total of maybe 12 or 13 videos on that channel. They're pretty easy to find if you just go back far enough.
Right. Okay. I didn't realize you had the other ones on there.
Yeah.
So then you took a hiatus.
Yes.
And then you came back. And when did you start making your new ones? Was it when the repo market started to go wild?
It was just a couple months ago. So there's really two phases of I started thinking, well, I'll do a series called Mafiocracy Now. And I did about 4 or 5 episodes a year ago, back in 2019.
Uh-huh.
And the last one I did was the one you referred to, Mommy, Where Does Money Come From? And that one really took it out of me because I was it took a lot of energy and time to figure out how do you present documentary information in a video with a live person. That's trickier. It's easier said than
right.
done. So that one right. really took it out of me. Then I took a break. But up until that time, up until Mommy, Where Does Money Come From, I am still complaining about what happened in 2008. Okay. So then I take about a year off. I move. I'm up in Chicago now. And I fire back up. And now I am trying to cover events in real time. My goal, in terms of my goal in all of this is, and this is going to sound insane for somebody, your listeners don't know, but I really, my model is Edward Gibbon. I want to do the decline and fall of the American empire in real time. And if I fall short of that goal, fine. At least I you know, I've tried. That's what I'm trying to
do. One of the things I want to make sure you pick up on is if you come into Solari, we have a section called News, Trends, and Stories. And there are 10 categories. We collect up all the headlines that we think are relevant. It's kind of an open source intelligence. And I use that to roll up into weekly money and markets coverage and then quarterly coverage on what are the most important trends and what are the most important stories. But we had so much flying out of the Fed and Treasury in terms of stimulus that we created a new category called the Stimulus Tracker, where we just pile up all the headlines related to both the central bank and Treasury stimulus, because it's coming so hot and furious. Right. And one of the, we put it in a table press, and one of the things I discovered during 2008 to 2012, if you don't keep a chronological record of all of this stuff, you'll go crazy later on.
Right.
And, you know, they're so good at doing the amnesia memory wipe. Oh. They have the neuralizer. Everybody has these memory wipes. Anyway, so I want to make sure you know about that, because if you can use it, if it can ease your burden, I'm hoping.
No, thank you very much. I've been kind of panicking internally, like, well, there's so much to parse through. I can't do it.
We have a wonderful team member who's in charge of keeping it updated. And he screamed at me 2 weeks ago. He says, "You got to get John Titus on." So he's your devoted fan. And I can arrange, you know, if you want to send him headlines to pour into it.
Yeah, that'd be great. I do this by myself. And so it's hard. That's why I don't do that many videos. It takes me a long time.
If we can keep the database updated for you, and you can certainly have access to it. Okay. Anyway, so you're in Chicago. Now, are you still doing legal work? Are you still representing clients?
Yes, I do. Okay. I have scaled back my practice. One of the other reasons that I think I was so angry about the bailouts was that I had been weaned on the notion that there's a level playing field, and if you get where you are in life, it's due to your own merits. And with the bailouts, we learned, no, that some people really are favorites, and they're going to get bailed out and you're not. And that really upset, I think it affected my identity, because I had my identity was so wrapped up in career success and money, that to hear that the system really was rigged all along, I think that was really what triggered my anger. And I really needed a spiritual rebirth to come to grips with my own anger and then to free myself of the bondage of thinking all these material things are important. And that was a separate process. But I'm there now. And so now I do legal work, but it's very much dialed back to where I can do videos like I want to do.
Right. Okay, so let's turn to a little background on the current stimulus flooding, because to me, I call it the plandemic. I don't call it the pandemic. The plandemic stimulus is just another round of bailouts.
Right.
So let's look a little bit. You did this video on where does money come from, which I think is a great introduction to the fiat currency model and sort of the debt growth model.
Right.
And we're not going to try and explain the model here, but I would encourage people who don't understand why it is such a disadvantage when one group of people can print money out of thin air.
Yes.
So they have as much money as they want at a zero cost of capital.
And lend it out at interest.
Right. And lend it out at interest while we're paying 15.99% on average on our credit cards. So it's interesting. I just reviewed a book on central banking, John, and it said, you know a society is going to fail when they make usury legal.
Right.
And went back and gave tons of historical examples. I hadn't focused on that, but, you know, here we are. But clearly we're in a model that I would describe as not sustainable. And it's hugely destructive of productivity, because the unproductive have found a way to increasingly subsidize them at the cost of everybody else. And they seem to, you know, their solution to each time, you know, they're ready to collapse, they just double down. I don't know if you want to say anything quickly about the model.
Well, the one thing I leave out of Mommy, Where Does Money Come From? Is that there are really two monetary tanks in the U.S. And that is what I failed to understand for so long. And the tank I am talking about in Mommy, Where Does Money Come From? Is our tank, the bank money tank, where the money come, all the money is generated by loans in commercial banks. There's a second tank called reserves, where all of the money there comes from the Federal Reserve. And unless you understand that, and I'm working on a video on that now, which I think is going to really, really drive home the point. Unless you understand that, you don't understand how the system really works and how you're being fleeced. And a lot of the single tank model is why a lot of people called for inflation back during quantitative easing, and it didn't happen.
Right.
So the other thing I will say about the mommy, where does money come from, and the bank money, is that the ability of people to lend money out at interest is one problem. But the more I read financial history and monetary history, the more I understand that there's a second and maybe even more significant problem, is that when you have debt-based money, then you have the money creators have at their leisure the ability to contract the money supply at will and cause depressions. And that—
Yeah, it caused fake scarcity.
Yes. Yeah. And that happened in 1920. It happened in 1929. That's what's going on now.
Right, exactly. And it's, you know, it's a domestic game and it's a global game because they've got, they're trying to put all of Asia in a bear trap.
Right.
So one of the things I thought was really interesting in the round of stimulus that we've seen in recent months is they took the reserve requirement to zero.
Right.
And nobody even said a thing.
No one bats an eye. That's a big difference between the 2008 now. Is that where are the bloggers talking about this?
It's unbelievable.
It's incredible, isn't it?
Well, I saw an article saying the lobbyists were pushing for a 0% reserve requirement. And I was outraged and publicized and talk about it in Money and Markets. And then I realized, oh, my God, they got it with no discussion. There's been no articles. Yeah. It was like, okay, now we're in never, you know, I keep saying we're in never, never land, but then it gets worse.
Yeah.
But what that means is, you know, that that in theory, the commercial banks can create money out of thin air to infinity.
Right. That's right. And I'll confess, Catherine, I don't know why they dispense with that requirement, because as businesses fail, which is going to happen when they have zero revenue because they're closed,
right?
But loans are going to go bad and money's going to get destroyed. So I just don't get the whole thing. I think there's a lot of times what I've noticed from watching the criminals in action is that something that doesn't make sense on Monday might make sense on Friday.
The thing, if you can package all the bad loans and sell them to the Fed at par, remember, the Fed has now authorized itself to, you know, to buy up essentially junk loans and junk paper and junk bonds.
Right.
So you can pull them all together and sell them to the Fed, and then the Fed can eat them.
That's one move. I don't know. We'll see. I really am looking forward to getting into your site and parsing through some of that data.
So I used to have a deputy who would say that HUD was where mortgages went to die.
Yeah.
But it was that game. You know, they'd roll up all the bad paper, stick it into us, and then we'd eat it. I just want to take a second to walk through the nuts and bolts of the federal credit mechanism, because there's a lot of misunderstanding here. And I don't think people understand how it works. So I just want to walk through it. So the New York Fed is sort of the lead ship in the Fed system, and it serves as the depository for the U.S. government.
Right.
So the U.S. government has a net bank, it's the New York Fed, but it's all the owners of the New York Fed who provide those services. So it's J.P. Morgan Chase, it's Citibank, and it's those big banks who are members of the Fed and own its stock. And I remember it was 1999, I think, when I sent an email to all the heads of PR at all the banks, including the New York Fed member bank. And I said, you know, who owns your shares?
Yeah, good luck.
In what percentage? And who runs your databases and systems? And do your members have access to your data, you know, and database and systems? And they wrote back and said, all of that is confidential.
Right.
Anyway, so we have, but we know the big New York Fed member banks, you know, own the Fed, but then they serve as the depository. They also serve as the primary dealer. So they market the securities.
Right.
They also do the big money creation. One of the things you pointed out, and where does the money come from, is, you know, you have three banks who are over 30% of the money supply.
Right. very dangerous. That's what gives them the gun to the head.
Yeah, that's part of it. I mean, they have so many guns to the head. It's hard. Have 20 machine guns. But they also, the New York Fed is the agent manager for the Exchange Stabilization Fund, reporting not to the bureaucracy of Treasury, but directly to the Secretary of Treasury. So if you FOIA Treasury for anything related to the Exchange Stabilization Fund, they can say they don't have it because they don't. It's down at the New York Fed.
Well, and it's in the same building. The ESF is in the New York Fed building.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. But in other words, it's a Treasury fund, but the bureaucracy at Treasury has no involvement.
Right. The ESF was created in whatever it was, 34 or 35, and it has had no oversight from the beginning.
Right.
So when you see the ESF involved in anything, it is there. I mean, no, I'm going to be blunt. I mean, it's there because they want opacity for whatever reason. It's right. Whenever you see the ESF, you should be thinking, okay, black box. Because there's something going on in the black box. They don't want me to know what it is. And so it's going on in there. Now, why wouldn't you do that from the Fed, since the Fed is privately owned? The reason you wouldn't do that through the Federal Reserve is that the Federal Reserve provides reserves. And commercial banks transact in reserves. They don't transact in bank money. So when you see the ESF is, like you say, it's a Treasury organization. It is able to transact in our money, which is bank money. So when you see the ESF, it means that rather than getting secrecy via Federal Reserve, which is only going to hide the bodies with reserves, you are now going to get secrecy in bank money. That's what that means. That's how I look at the ESF.
Right, but you have broad authority to intervene in all the markets.
Correct.
And it means private banks can intervene in all the markets using the Treasury credit and using the Treasury assets.
Correct. Yes.
Right. So I call it the mother of all slush funds.
That's a great way of putting it. Yeah. You're not going to find out what's going on.
What you see in terms of these operations, you know, whenever somebody says, well, why doesn't the Department of Justice enforce against JPMorgan Chase? And the reason is because they're controlled by JPMorgan Chase. Their check is controlled by in other words, the governmental financial operations are totally dependent on and controlled by these entities, including their ability to finance their operations.
That's right. And that's something that took me a long time to understand, Catherine. I'm relative, compared to you, new to this. Let's say 12 years into figuring out, wait a minute, the civics book is incorrect. I'm figuring out that when it comes to sovereignty, the most important power is the power to create money. That's a sovereign power. It's the Constitution. Let me take a step back. There has been a historical debate over the centuries, essentially, on which is more important. Do you want guns or would you rather have money? And so various people have taken various positions. Machiavelli said, you want the guns. He didn't say the guns. I think he said the iron, whatever the term was back then. But he was writing before the Central Bank of England was created, the Bank of England, in 1694. After that, you had people like Jefferson saying, no, central banks are way more dangerous than standing armies. And so when you come to sovereign powers and splitting up sovereign powers, the power of money creation is, in my way of thinking, the most powerful sovereign power there is. It's the ultimate sovereign power. So when you say that J.P. Morgan controls the Justice Department, I would totally agree with that, because J.P. Morgan Chase is not only a commercial bank able to create bank money, it's part of the Federal Reserve and thus has extensive control over the creation of reserves. So they got all their bases covered. Of course, the DOJ, which is really back to, it's the iron or the force or the guns, of course it answers to J.P. Morgan Chase. J.P. Morgan Chase has the monetary power.
Right. Well, I also think, if you look at the entire derivatives market, I think it's all a U.S. government position. And J.P. Morgan Chase and some of the others are managing it, and they can't afford to, it's not like they can say, oh, well, we'll take it back and have Treasury do it. They don't know how to do it.
Right.
They're completely dependent.
They farmed it out.
Right. So there's another there's another aspect to this, which has become more and more important. The federal government doesn't have financial sovereignty, but it also doesn't have information sovereignty.
Big problem.
So you don't have people internal to the government who... So the president can't have a private conversation with the prime minister of Australia without 17 intelligence agencies listening and leaking it all to the Washington Post.
Right.
So you don't have information sovereignty. And because I have to say the Five Eyes system has sort of changed a little bit the balance of power between JP Morgan Chase and the, you know, AT&T.
Right.
So there's a definite sort of telco defense contractor aspect to power, and then there's the central bank power.
Right.
But they don't have information sovereignty, and they don't have financial sovereignty. And we just had the Pentagon admit that 3 UFO videos are real, and so now they're admitting that they don't even control the airspace.
The sovereignty issue is a real issue, because I think you and I would both agree, if you don't have sovereignty, if we the people, I mean the government, which is ultimately we the people, if you read the first 3 words of the Constitution, if we the people don't have sovereignty, that means there's been a coup d'etat.
Right.
And so then the question is, well, when did the coup d'etat take place? You would say, and I think I've heard you say, it was in the late 1990s. It had been effected by then. I would say, I'm not really sure about that. It was perfected in 2012 once you had the collateral consequences doctrine.
Right.
Then the collateral consequences is the formal recognition that certain banks have criminal immunity. And if you have criminal immunity, you are de facto the sovereign, right?
Right.
I mean, even the president doesn't have criminal immunity. The bankers have a legal privilege, criminal immunity, which not even the president have. If you have criminal immunity, you're able to replicate at your leisure any sovereign power you choose to, because you can't be prosecuted.
So here's what I would say. I would say the financial coup started in October 1997. No, I'd had the president of CalPERS say to me, it's too late. They've given up on the country. They're pulling all the money out starting in the fall. And that fall, which is the beginning of fiscal 1998, is when the money started disappearing from DOD and HUD. And it kept disappearing and disappearing. Meantime, they're running around the world doing shock doctrine, you know, in Russia, in Eastern Europe, et cetera. But they're sucking money out. And I believe to suck that money out, they had to engage in massive securities fraud. And it wasn't, and the reason you're absolutely right about perfecting it, it wasn't until they were able to put that securities fraud back to the federal government, the taxpayers, and use the Fed to do it in 2008 to 2012, that basically they tore up the trail. And then as soon as they put the immunity in, you know, then they're in the catbird seat. They've stolen the money. They've torn up the securities, the fraudulent securities they used to steal the money. And now they're free to rock and roll. And they keep stealing.
Yeah.
Because if you look at the money that's disappeared since 2012, you know, I was thinking, oh, okay, they clean up the mess and, you know, and that's it. No, they've kept on stealing. So the money missing from the federal government is up to $21 trillion. You know, and if you thought that was a lot, if so far in the pandemic, it looks like it's up to about $10 trillion if you look at both the central bank and treasury. But before I get there, I just wanted to mention one thing. October 2008, when Dr. Skidmore wrote his, Dr. Skidmore is from Michigan State University, came in to do a complete survey on the missing money, something I had never done, offered to have a group of graduate students at Michigan State University go through all the DOD documents. And I think at that point, I had the number up to about $12.5 trillion.
Wow.
And he was a skeptic. So they went through the documents. He kept calling me and saying, oh my God, we found another trillion. And it went all the way up to $18 trillion. Then we wrote the report. And then finally, they kept going. It went up to $21 trillion. But that was 2015. It looked like in the last year of Obama, they did a huge, I called it a cut and run then. Mm-hmm. But there was $6.8 trillion in 1 year. It was the largest amount in a year yet. And so we published the report. There was a lot of attention. I won't bore you with the details, but you could see that they were extremely concerned. And they kept saying, we're doing an audit, which is something they've said for 2 decades. And then they can't do it. Anyway, before they finalized the audit, they created this Federal Accounting Standards Advisory Board Statement 56, which basically says, long and short, we can keep secret books.
Yeah.
And not only can we keep secret books in the 24 covered agencies, we can also keep secret books in about 150 different related corporations and entities. And in combination with the classification laws, all the contracts and banks that work for us can also keep secret books. It's quite, once you get into it, it goes on and on and on. But I basically said, okay, well, it's over. You know, whatever the financial coup is, there's no sovereignty. And now they're basically saying, look, we can do whatever we want. We don't have to justify anything to you or tell you anything about what we're doing.
Right.
You know, we have complete secrecy. So that brings us to last September. We had Powell come in as Fed chairman, and you can tell they have a vision of what they're going to do. They're going to raise interest rates. They're going to tighten up. All of a sudden, bam, they hit a wall in the repo market. And then the next round of bailouts begins last September with the repo market. So why don't we start there? And why don't you tell us a little bit about all the different fun and games they've been having since the big Fed pivot in 2019?
Yeah, so that starts with the New York Fed and the repo market, like you said, where the New York Fed starts to come into the overnight lending market and bailing out banks. So they would lend out, I don't know, you know, $20 billion at 5 p.m., and that gets paid back, in theory, at 9 a.m., by a financial institution. And so that's going on. And it's a big deal, but it's not that big. But it does start well before the pandemic, right? It starts before anybody's heard of COVID or any kind of virus. That's going on for a few months. And then the pandemic hits, and then the Fed really goes crazy and starts in with all these programs. So basically, the two biggest ones is buying treasuries from banks, U.S. treasuries, which isn't so much a problem because treasuries are already backed by the full faith and credit of the United States government. It also begins buying mortgage-backed securities again. Remember, it had let a lot of those roll off its balance sheet in an attempt to taper, and the market throws a hissy fit. So the Fed's now back doing that. But there are all these other things on the balance sheet that are so curious that they were coming from 2008, like the money market mutual fund liquidity facility. There's money going into that. The most curious one I've seen recently is Maiden Lane starts. You know, that was the vehicle set up in the—
Oh, that was so ugly.
In the wake of Lehman Brothers. And it's like,
right,
what is that still? Why have you, why, what is that still doing on the balance sheet, number one? Why are you now pumping money into it, number two? And more recently, why did you just change its name to something else? You don't see the name Maiden Lane on there. So there's so much going on the balance sheet right now that you figure there is some tectonic shift that you're not telling me about, and we need to kind of parse through the data, and we need to do so in an intelligent way. And where I am in my videos is trying to explain, okay, let's be clear on which type of money we're talking about, because what the Fed is now doing, as I'm reading it, is the Fed can only deal with reserves, can't really deal with bank money. That's why when you see, you know, a discount window operation is a simple operation, because a bank, a commercial bank like JP Morgan Chase, they transact in reserves. So they can borrow reserves. The Fed can print up reserves, click, click, click on the computer, credit JP Morgan with the reserves. JP Morgan sells an asset to the Fed in exchange for the reserve money, right? Mm-hmm. When you deal with a non-commercial bank, say a financial, let's say a hedge fund, and a hedge fund, let's say, wants to sell a mortgage-backed security to the Fed, it can't do that directly because a hedge fund transacts, like you and I do, in bank money, and the Fed doesn't do that. So what you need now is you need three parties. You need the seller of the asset, which is the hedge fund. Okay, so they transfer the mortgage-backed security to the Fed. The Fed then transfers reserves to the commercial bank, and then the commercial bank creates new bank money and transfers that bank money to the hedge fund. So it's a three-way operation,
right,
with everything balancing out. So now when you see this explosion of data on the Fed's balance sheet, it's really going to be I don't relish this task at all. It's going to be a big pain to go through and figure out who's doing what because of the two monetary tank system. And until I can kind of get my arms around which tank is being drawn on and how are, you know, non-commercial banks being you know, used with intermediary commercial banks to affect the XYZ transaction, I can't really speculate on what's going on. I just know that something massive is going on in conjunction with what you're talking about with the FASB change, these new rules and new regulations coming in to dispense with transparency are really making this a hard job, but I'm bound and determined to do it.
Right. And so one of the things to look out for, I always said I could have told Epstein he was a dead man as soon as they adopted FASB 56, because what it means is they can launder whatever they want, however they want.
Right.
So if you look at appointing BlackRock to run the bond portfolio for the Fed, I'm assuming part of the reason they're doing that is they want to free the Fed from any last sort of disclosure obligations. They can put a lot, you know, and if you look at how big an operation is, if you're the market, you can't tell if BlackRock's doing it for, you know, index fund A
right.
versus the, you know, the Fed portfolio. So if it's over at the Fed, the dealers will be able to see a lot more about what's going on. You park it over at BlackRock, it, you know, it's going to make it that much harder to kind of figure out what's going on.
That makes total sense to me, because remember back in 2008, 2009, 10, the Fed lost a Freedom of Information Act case against a guy named Mark Pittman of Bloomberg. He brought a FOIA. He won on summary judgment in the Southern District of New York. It was affirmed.
Right, and I'll be blunt. I think it cost him his life.
Well, yeah, I think that's probably right. He died at 51.
Right.
You know, as someone who's 54, that one hit a little close to home.
Right.
But yeah, I think that was a big wrench. So when you now say BlackRock has been brought in, and to the extent the Fed can, it wants to, you know, siphon off work to BlackRock, because BlackRock is not a government institution. The Fed is a hybrid, as you know, and so the Board of Governors is subject to the FOIA requirements, whereas the New York Fed is not.
Right.
But the Fed just doesn't like to take the chance. They know, we all know that BlackRock isn't subject to FOIA. So what you're saying
right.
makes total sense, right? Forget it.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So I have another theory that I wanted to ask you about, because I think – you know, it's such a no-brainer if you're an investment advisor to say, look, shift completely out of the bond market. You know, you are better off in stocks related to real assets or real assets and living with the volatility than dealing with the credit and liquidity problems that could hit the bond market. And so, you know, that's pretty obvious. Now, that's a real problem, because how are you going to hold up the bond market if you can't hold up the junk portion? Because if things cycle down and you get a real debt spiral, the Treasury is going to suck up all the money. And the thing that will implode the fixed income markets is going to be in the lower credit area. And suddenly we have the Fed buying up all the lower credit area. What a coincidence.
Yeah.
Does that make sense to you?
Well, I, you know, that's above my pay grade. I'm not, my financial, I'm serious. My financial training is essentially zero. I have to read a million documents to get a paragraph's worth of knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
So that doesn't make, you know, that I can't make heads or tails of that. What I can tell you is that with the extent that Treasury is now involved in the Fed's balance sheet and the printing of this money, which is bank money, at the same time, so more and more bank money is being created because people aren't working and you're sending that out. But people aren't working. The problem you now have is you have a lot of bank money dollars floating out there with against no productivity.
Right.
So now I really do think that we face the prospects for massive inflation. In other words, 2008, in a lot of ways, with the QE and the money printing,
right.
I think was a head fake in a way
right.
to get people used to the idea, oh, we can print money and it won't
right.
cause inflation.
Right.
No, you can't. It depends on which money you were talking about.
Well, remember, you know, they've had a couple of different ways of dealing with deflation, one of which was massive global, you know, globalization meant massive labor deflation.
Right.
Which really helped you offset inflation. But that's pretty much over. and technology helps with deflation. There are other things that can help with deflation, but you're kind of running out of big offsets, which is why I think you're seeing what you're seeing right now. This kind of shock treatment is a way of engineering a sudden deflation.
Yeah. Well, that's what depressions have been. The sudden, sudden contractions, right?
Right.
And so the question is, well, all of these things, regardless of how much money is missing and, where the money is going, the depressions and whatnot, they're all control games. When you say that $21 trillion is missing or $29 trillion is
missing. Right, it's just a control game.
It's not that they want that money because they have the ability to print the money. It's right. That they don't want you to have that money because right. That gives, it's really a power grab way more than it is a money grab. They don't need
absolutely.
The money. It's a right. Power grab. And absolutely. So what we're seeing with these suddenly, these wild gyrations in the market and these sudden contractions in credit and sudden contractions in money, it's simply a power grab. It's just dressed right. Up in dollars.
Right. So let me bring up one other thing, because one of the things we're watching is a significant abrupt drop in the U.S.-China trade balance. So say 2 years ago, it would have been $40 to $50 billion a month of trade deficit with China. It's dropping down to, in March, it was $11 billion. And my guess is April is going to be half of that, if not less.
Wow.
So one of my questions is, did the Chinese decide they weren't going to take dollars all of a sudden?
I don't know. That seems pretty draconian to me. I mean, maybe they did, maybe they didn't. Here's what I think China communicated clearly. JP Morgan is not controlling us.
Right.
We're going to control ourselves. And in a debt-based system that's interest-based, that is geometrically progressing, you can't right. Have that. You have to right. Grab more and more and more and more and have more wars right. And bigger projects and everything else. And so right. With all of these recent Fed actions and Treasury actions, the aroma of desperation is quite distinct. It's a big power struggle. China's not going to give in.
So at the end of the year, every investment banker, every investment advisor I talked with, whether in Europe or in Asia or America, basically said, S&P long in the tooth, it's time to rebalance to Europe and the emerging markets. The dollar's finally headed down. It's over. And then suddenly, the plandemic happens.
Yeah.
And it was one of the most miraculous saves I've ever seen.
Yeah.
It was a miracle. It was just a miracle. And then suddenly everybody's flying back in the dollar. And the Treasury for the last, when I did the equity overview last week, Treasuries on 12 months were up. The long Treasury ETF, John, was up 31%.
Wow.
Yeah. Now, if you and I had been, if somebody had asked us to bet if that could happen 12 months ago, I dare say I would have bet a lot of money it was impossible.
Right. Sure.
So I would say, whatever's going on, it was pretty miraculous for both the dollar and the S&P.
Right. And also, that's one thing you'll see in the Fed balance sheet, too, is the swaps, the foreign currency right. Swaps are way
exactly.
Up.
Exactly.
And then, right. And that is purely in response to this newfound demand for dollars over in Europe. Imagine that.
Well, here's the thing. Coming out of 2008, the way they came out was to have the world, but particularly Asia, borrow massive amounts of dollars. And I think part of what they're trying to do is throw China into a dollar bear trap.
Meaning?
You cut off their ability to earn dollars, but meantime, they got to pay you the dollars on the debt.
Well,
if you look around yep. The world, we're looking at a giant entrapment
yep.
by the people who control the system. So let me say one thing, and then let's turn to small business. The Exchange Stabilization Fund, one of the things that Mnuchin and Powell have done is they've put the Exchange Stabilization Fund as a backstop on a whole bunch of these facilities that the Fed is not authorized to do.
Right.
So the Fed doesn't have the authority to do all this crazy business with the bank loans and the small business loans and all this other stuff. And so what they've got is they're limited their liability by putting the Exchange Stabilization Fund. And my interpretation of that is they've basically all got a big put to the taxpayer. You think that's fair to say?
I think that's exactly right. Yeah.
Okay. Now, one of my character flaws is that I get overly frustrated when people come up with crazy cute kind of theories about what's going on at the Fed. And one of the few times in the last 3 months that I've lost my temper is I get these emails when it says, "Don't worry, it's all fixed. Trump has taken over the Fed." Have you dealt with any of this yet?
Yeah, I was in an interview where that was brought up, and I said, that is the most ludicrous theory I've ever heard. No, I'm not kidding. That is just absolutely bananas.
Well, apparently Michael Tellinger made a whole new video about how it's all fixed because Trump has taken control of the Fed. You know, and I will respond when I get those emails, because I've gotten several of them this week, is I just say total BS and I refuse to address it.
Yeah, it's not, you got to pick your battles. And that one's so stupid that I refuse to waste time on it.
Well, I'm assuming the reason I wanted to go through the nuts and bolts of the sort of how the credit mechanism works is I think it reflects somebody who might think that hasn't sat down and understand how the system works,
right,
as a mechanical, you know, roles and responsibilities. Who does what? How does the money work? How does the money flow? They just don't have any kind of understanding of the nuts and bolts. And that's why I really want them to watch some of your videos, because I think you do a very good job of laying that out.
Thank you.
And the more we can help people understand those nuts and bolts and how sort of it works mechanically, then they won't get misled by this stuff.
That's what I'm trying to do. One of the reasons I do videos is to educate myself, because as you know, when you try to teach something,
right,
you learn something. And that,
right,
I'm learning as I go. So my next video will be on the two-tank monetary, the split-circuit monetary system, which is a big part of the shell game.
Right.
But I do try to lay it out, like you're saying, in a nuts-and-bolts way. I'm not hand-waving. I have to go in and learn it.
So let's turn to the economic impact. We don't need to talk a lot about the CARE Act or the tax changes, but I did want to mention Dr. Larry Lindsey, who was somebody I had a lot of respect for when I worked in the Bush administration, and he, to his credit, he got fired by the second Bush, along with Paul O'Neill. But he gave a speech the other day. It's fascinating. And one of the things he talked about was he expects the deficit for 2020 at the end of the year to be $5 trillion. And he said the inflation over the next 10 years is going to be astonishing. Now, I think there are ways that they can bring the inflation down. So I think there are games they can play. But here's what I wanted to tell you that I thought was really interesting. He said that in the Democratic states especially, they've rigged the unemployment compensation, so it's approximately 30% more on average than what people were making at work. So they won't want to go back to work. And then they're planning on rolling that in July and then rolling it again in October in front of the election. And then after the elections, the Democrats can win, they're planning on converting it to a universal basic income.
Yeah, I would. Yeah.
And so it's basically, if you look at all the things they've done to destroy small business, it's the last attack on small business and creating complete dependency.
Right, because now you've got to pay people $25 an hour to show up to work, or else they're going to stay home and make $20 an hour, right?
Right, so what Lindsey says is, if you think inflation is bad now, you ain't seen nothing yet.
I totally agree with that. And I will tell you, you know, you it's okay to have more money and print a sea of money as long as you have the productivity to back it up. You have the business output. But if people are sitting at home twiddling their thumbs and they're on Twitter all day and on Facebook and watching YouTube videos, they're not working. They're not producing anything. You can't have a big, huge sea of money, and you're going to have massive inflation if you do. So that's why I completely agree with Lindsey's. I mean, maybe for
right,
a different reason, we're going to see huge inflation if this nonsense continues.
Well, if you let's say he's talking about a universal basic income of say $30,000 to $36,000 a year. If you've basically got the whole population not working and you're doing it by printing, the question is where are you going to get the economic value?
You're not. And that's an unsustainable model. People have to produce. They have to produce food and goods and services. to be consumed. Otherwise, did you have what's the money chasing?
So I continue to hear, I don't spend a lot of time listening to it, but I continue to hear these various Washingtonian, you know, it's always folks invariably have spent their whole life drawing a government check, explaining how it's no problem, we can just print all the money.
No. No, that's not good.
Okay, so global GDP, JP Morgan Chase says in the second quarter down 40% for US. Yeah, so Goldman came out and said down 25%, then JP Morgan said down 40%. We just saw a survey, I think, by the Chamber of Commerce saying two-thirds of business say if this keeps up for 6 months, they're gone. So 6 months from now, we could have one-third of the small businesses that were existing when it started. And in the meantime, you have the FANG monopoly. I mean, basically, the Department of Justice has become a monopoly creator. What they do is they liquidate small business and foreign businesses into monopolies.
That's being spot on, yes.
Right. And I call them the Sheriff of Nottingham. So they're kind of hurting. They're shutting down small business and then using the, you know, their ability to listen to everybody on Zoom globally to sort of suck everything up into FANG and the big monopolies.
Yeah, every industry is the same. Every industry has five or six competitors or companies, and that's it. And then the only counterbalance to that is small business. And they're going to wipe that out?
Well, I was at the Aspen Institute in 2017 for a conference on cryptocurrencies. And they sent in this sort of billionaire venture capital guy into one of the panels that Ed Griffith and I was on. You know, he was kind of there to make sure we didn't get too much done. And he had this incredible dead eyes. It was like, sweetie, I've been up in the spaceship and I know what's really going on. You don't. And he looked at me afterwards and he said, you know, I buy all these small businesses so I can just figure out how to re-engineer and do everything with software and automation and robotics. He said, but, you know, we can do the whole economy. Every business in this economy, we can roll up into AI and software and robotics, and we don't need people. And that's what we're going to do.
That's horrifying. But I believe it, because if you look at the history of depressions, the 1920 depression was about crushing farmers. The 29 depression, also intentionally created, was about crushing industrialists. And this one is about crushing small business and buying up businesses for pennies on the dollars. That's what's going on. And it's going on in real time. And what blows me away, Catherine, more than anything else, you know, Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr., the great American jurist of the early 20th century, said, even a dog knows the difference between being tripped over and being kicked. But you have
That's great.
You have to remember, though, that he said that before the advent of television. And now we have a situation where the dogs still know they're being kicked, but the people do not, because they are asleep in front of the television. You know, you have to go to Richard M. Nixon for the TV era, and his quote was, you know, the American people won't believe anything unless it's on television. And it's totally true.
Did I ever
true.
Tell you the Sopranos TV show story? I got to tell you this.
No, I haven't heard it. Tell me.
So I came out of the, you know, watching the corruption at HUD. So I'm litigating with the Department of Justice and watching the housing bubble just skyrocket. And I'm trying to warn people about what's going on with the securities fraud and everything. And it's just, you know, I was speaking in New Zealand. I was speaking in Europe. I'm speaking in America. And it's like nobody can hear. There's a force field. Anyway, so in 2001 or two, the Soprano TV show came out with a series of four shows on HUD single family foreclosure corruption that was the basic, if you look at the basic patterns of fraud that build up into the securities fraud, it was the basic pattern that I used to always describe. And I had an old roommate from college at the University of Pennsylvania. I'm driving down the highway and my old roommate calls me and she says, Fitz, have you seen the Soprano TV show? And I said, yeah. And this was somebody who had come and stayed with me when the physical harassment got really bad in Washington before I sold and left. And so she knew all about how bad it was. And she said, it's unbelievable. I guess what you're saying is true. I said, wait a minute. I was the assistant secretary of housing. I was the lead financial advisor to the Department of Housing and Urban Development. I was a partner and member of the, you know, Dylan Reed board on Wall Street. But yet you don't believe me until it's on the Soprano TV show? And she said, yes, that's right.
Yeah. I totally believe that story.
Right. And that's when I said, in America, fact is fiction and fiction is fact.
Yeah. It is amazing. People actually think, they watch a TV show that they know about a subject. They know about pandemics because there have been all these movies on pandemics. The amount of pseudoscience is just unbelievable right now.
But here's what I would say, because I spend my whole life talking to Solaria subscribers and our network, and they're all totally hip. But you have people from many, many different backgrounds. And a lot of them are just not interested in finance. You know, they're busy doctors, they're nurses, yeah, they're school teachers, they've got families, their hands are full. And one of the reasons I really look everybody into, you know, watching your videos and following you is I think you do a marvelous job of making this much more interesting, much more understandable. And we're all going to have to start getting our minds around how the money works, because yeah, that's how most of us are getting played. And if we can see, you know, it's very interesting because I know nothing about science, but I've been, as the pandemic took off, I'm just watching the financial patterns, and most of the time the financial patterns will explain what's going on.
Of course, buy the rumor, sell the news.
Right.
Right?
Right. But, you know, the miracle of the dollar save.
Oh.
And you know, the CEOs in Congress getting out at the high in January and February, and then the miraculous dollar save in March. I said,
yeah. And I'll tell you something else. I want to go back to something you said about China, which really resonated in from reading financial history. I can tell you there are basically two ways to destroy a currency. One is to lose a war, and China, I don't think, is going to lose a war, certainly not with Russia on its side. The other way is to borrow money in a foreign currency and then to watch helplessly, right, as that currency rises against your own.
Right.
So that's right. What I would imagine. That's
our edge here is, yes, you know, they owe us a lot of dollars. And if you can bring the trade deficit down, then it's harder to earn dollars. And then, of course, you've got the war over the food supply. Okay, so tell us a little bit about what you're doing next. Tell us what's next.
Well, next I am going to... the very next episode, which I really think you're going to watch, it's going to be very entertaining because it's going to really bring home the notion of the split circuit monetary system. Then I'm going to turn to a massive misconception about quantitative easing. And then the next step after that is to try to do what you were talking about, which is get my hands around the data of the Fed and the Treasury and try to make sense of what is going on there and see if I can spot patterns. That is why I'm so happy to hear that data is at Solari.
Well, after this is over, I'm going to send you a couple things because I want to make sure whatever we have that can make your production lighter, easier, more fun.
Well, thank you.
You know, because I'm a great believer that transparency can shift everything.
Yes, I totally agree.
They
speaking
the
of transparency, another
live in the dark.
Another thing I really want to cover is some monetary history in the U.S. that I don't think people know, because I find it very increasingly difficult to track down books that tell the truth back when certain events were happening. And I want to expose and bring the light.
Do you have Pieces of Eight, Edwin Vieira's book on monetary history?
No, and I'm not, I got to confess, I'm not likely to get it because... I've got some questions there, but anyway.
We've done a bunch on monetary history, so I'll send you those links too in case they're of interest. But, you know, I agree with you. The more history we have on the monetary history, the more you can see this pattern over time.
Yes. Yes. That's the key thing, is being able to detect patterns by looking over time. Unfortunately, it's getting harder and harder and harder to find books about the Depression and about 1920 or whatever than it was before. Google is not a friendly organization to history.
Right.
In a lot of ways, I think it's No, I'm serious.
No, they're the neuralizer. You know, we've had tremendous problems over the last 3 months with books being censored off of Amazon.
Yeah.
Or books disappearing in the mail, or books being censored in a variety of ways.
Yes.
There's a very sneaky censorship going on. And one of the things I've said to everybody, if you want a book, get it now.
Yes.
I just ordered 10 books that I've always wanted, and I realized I got to get them now.
You got to get them now. History is being erased.
Right. So I want to ask you one last question, John, about a cut and run, because if you look at the stimulus that's coming out now over the last 3 months, you know, it looks to me like we're in danger of a cut and run. And when this is over, you will have exhausted the dollar capacity, and we're in for either a radical reengineering of the U.S. government or of a real implosion of the U.S. government. This could go many different ways. So I don't want to try and prophesy which way it's going to go. That's not my business.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the question is, can you come out the other side and still have a working federal credit mechanism with debt going right up the S curve?
I doubt that, number one. But like you say, I'm not in the business of prophecy. I think the prudent thing to do is to assume the worst case scenario. And I think your worst case scenario should be that the U.S. government and the United States as a nation may not emerge from this intact.
Right. Sad to say, but there it is.
Very sad. And that is one of the missions. You know, one of my main missions in doing Best Evidence in Mafiocracy Now is to lay a record, is simply to lay a record, so that if we don't make it to the other side, maybe somebody on the other side picks it up and says, ah, this is what went wrong.
Well, you know, it's interesting. When the Soviet Union came apart in 1989 and 90, what a glorious opportunity there was. And I would say that we've completely blown it. But somebody's certainly gotten off with a great deal of money and resources.
For sure.
Right.
You know, for sure. But the currently configured monetary system, I don't think is long for this world. And I think that is one of the reasons we're seeing the gyrations that we're seeing, is that we're witnessing the last stages of a geometrically progressing system in a finite world.
Right. Well, the thing that's happening now, I'm writing something called State of Currency, and I'll send it to you when it's done. But if you look at they're trying to extend and keep the old system going, and they're trying to bring in the new. And if you look at the new system they're bringing in, I don't think it's going to work. So that's going to make it a very interesting process. And I think it's dependent on the rest of us to say, okay, if it hopefully fails, what next? Because, and I will tell you, one of the most hopeful things I've seen in recent history is Rupert Sheldrake has a new video up. It's an interview where he basically does a dialogue on the last 400 years of science. And what he describes is the sort of evolution of a materialist model, where you create a group of people who are hypermaterialists. And as a result of being hypermaterialists, they sort of look at the world and the economy and man as a machine. And it becomes increasingly divorced from actual reality. And I realized watching this, I said, you know, part of what we're watching is the materialist economy that makes no sense, you know, is constantly on the lookout for more subsidy to keep itself going because it makes no sense. And this is their last desperate attempt to lock everything up so they can keep themselves going. I don't think it's going to work, but you know, a couple billion people could die in the process of getting it to fail.
Boy, that's a real, that's a dark possibility, but it is a possibility nonetheless. I'm sorry to say. It's hard. I got to be honest. There are days where it's hard to see a good outcome from all of this.
I'm still an optimist because I don't know if you've ever heard this story. When I created Hamilton, I left the Bush administration. I said, these guys are going to get a hold of the technology and kill us all. We need another plan. So I went to work to figure out how, you know, bottom up, you could create wealth and productivity bottom up in communities, basically equity for for local places, an optimization of total equity in place. And what I discovered is the wealth potential was so enormous. I had totally underestimated how much this centralizing government money had suppressed the real productivity and wealth potential. And what I will tell you is the existing wealth, we once had a little investment club and everybody had to vote on how much the existing wealth was of what could be possible if we were, you know, if freedom could really prevail, if you had civilization. And we decided the current wealth was 1 to 10% of what was possible. And that was before we understood half of the technology that is existing. So the thing that keeps me an optimist is I know as an engineering matter, unless there are risks I'm not aware of, which is always possible, you know, the potential for economic wealth, if we were capable of civilization, is just fantastic.
That's exactly right. And one of the things about the $21 trillion and $29 trillion missing is that's really a testament to that they could steal all this money because the system is so productive.
Isn't it incredible?
In its, its innate form. If you left it alone, the wealth would be just mind-boggling.
So $24 to $29 trillion was the bailouts. $21 trillion is the missing money. That takes you up to $50 trillion. You throw in $1 trillion for the pandemic. That's $60 trillion. You know, and there are lots of sort of spooky people who tell me, oh, you don't know half of it.
Well, there, you know, I got to wonder, when you remember that story from June of 2009 about the two Japanese businessmen in Chiasso, Italy?
Yeah.
And they look in their luggage and there's $134.5 billion in bearer bonds inside their luggage. And you read a story like that, it's like, what in the Sam Hill? Am I on drugs? What is really going on here? How much money is out there?
Well, I think if you look at, you know, we did a conference in 2014 where I did the black budget and Farrell did the hidden system of finance, you know, including the Japanese with the bearer bonds. And if you look at what they've been able to do since they created the 47 and 49 Act with sort of the secret money in a variety of different forms, you know, and that's before this $60 trillion in globalization. It's a fantastic amount of money. And it's exactly, you know, I always say it's like the guy who's supporting two families out of one paycheck and one family doesn't know the other families. I mean, we financed a whole new civilization out of one budget.
Well,
secretly.
One of the things, if you, you know, when I look at the dual tank monetary system, the bank money versus the reserve money, it begs the question, well, why are we limited to two forms of dollars? Is there a third tank?
That's a... Well, as soon as you've got that video, I want you to come back so we can talk about that.
Catherine, this video is going to be so up your alley, you are not going to believe it.
Oh, I can't wait. I can't wait. Well, John Titus, thank you so much for everything you do. Thank you for being on Earth at this time. And certainly thank you for joining us on a Solari Report. It's just a real privilege to know you.
My pleasure, Catherine, and the honor is all mine.